Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, James Meadway will talk about the economic dimensions of the crisis, and science journalist David Quammen will talk about zoonotic diseases, ones that spread from animals to humans, including AIDS, Ebola, and our latest nemesis, COVID-19. We're faced by immense horrors of disease and death in a society that has deliberately made itself less capable of dealing with such crises. Morbidity and mortality we have always with us, but decades of austerity and the erosion of state capacity have made things far worse than they need to be. The immediate human consequences of this pandemic are crushing, but along with it have already come huge disruptions of our economic lives. Thursday morning brought the news that over 3 million Americans applied for unemployment insurance, 5 times the previous record, and almost 2 times the number already drawing jobless benefits. And this is just the beginning. Here with more on the economic dimensions is James Meadway, a former advisor to the British Labour Party, now working on a book that was initially going to be about Jeremy Corbyn's economics, but whose scope has been greatly altered by events beyond his control. James Meadway. This crisis that we're in now, is there any kind of precedent for it in history? As far as I can see, there's nothing like this in economic history that we really know of, is there?
Not really. I mean, not a sort of pandemic of this scale and of the particular kind of ferocity and the way it targets certain groups of people particularly ferociously. I mean, it's the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions that are most at risk here. But the impact of it, in the sense of it being so infectious that you have to remove people from the labour market, from where they normally socialise, from really almost any form of social contact, that is unprecedented. And I don't think there's any recent event. I mean, for all the economists who start off by saying, is it 2008-09? Well, it's not. It's bigger than that. Is it the Great Depression? Well, it's not. It's bigger than that. The nearest thing we've got really is something like World War II in terms of its sort of overwhelming scale of impact on the global economy.
But even during World War II, we were able to send lots of people to work making munitions. Now we have people being absented from work. It's really, first of all, a reminder of how important labor is to capital, although they don't like to talk about that part. But, you know, there's just nothing like this forced absence from work we've seen before.
Exactly. And this is where the wartime analogies, which have started to proliferate, break down somewhat. In that, you know, if you want a wartime economy, you have to produce as much as possible in a very focused way. So you're making more tanks than you are television sets or whatever. But you have to sort of produce as much as you can and squeeze every last drop out of the economy. The aim with this one is exactly the opposite. You need to wind down most things. And, you know, most forms of work that people still do involve having to work with other people and going to places that other people are in. And that means you can't do that kind of work at this point in time. So it's a kind of, it's a hibernation of the economy. It's an anti-wartime economy. You have to do as little as possible for great chunks of what passes for capitalism there.
Yeah, so, you know, the approaches to this, I can understand the urge to you know, write checks or maintain payrolls or provide all kinds of aid that even our own terrible governments are contemplating now. But how does that really address the underlying problem, which is this massive non-work? At some point, there's going to be nothing to buy, regardless of whether people have money now. So how is this the cure appropriate for the disease?
Well, there's two parts to that. I mean, the first one is that at least for this sort of crisis period, what you need is the core bits of the economy, the stuff that matters. So your utilities, the lights have to stay on, the gas has to keep going out of the taps and keeping your heating going. Broadband, which is, you know, completely essential, I would have thought, at this point in time, just to stop people going, if nothing else, absolutely mad in sort of social isolation. You have to have the medical supplies working, you have to have food supplies working. This is the core of the economy and that has to work. Everything else doesn't matter so much. So at least for this part of the crisis, everything else, you either pay people enough so that they are secure and not going out to work and you just put a hold on things, that you can do for a period of time whilst the worst of this passes. Because what we know from the biology of this virus is that, and what we know from previous epidemics is that, you know, immunity does build up, most people recover, this thing does pass, that will happen at some point. And the challenge is to minimize the number of deaths in the meantime, not to sort of, as was briefly being attempted, actually not briefly, quite a long period of time, I think, was attempted by this government to minimise the economic damage, which is an intensely stupid thing to do and probably one of the most catastrophic policy decisions ever taken in this country in peacetime. It is spectacularly bad and it will lead to many more deaths and already is leading to many more deaths than need to have taken place. So you kind of have the core of the economy, which has to be directed and planned in a way that we haven't seen for a very, very long period of time, certainly not in the West. The rest of it is, for now, held in kind of abeyance, that people are just left to sit at home. It does mean some economic activity is taking place. You can see home deliveries are still occurring, but a lot of white-collar workers are able to work from home in one form or another. I mean, I should say one of the striking impacts of this is a sort of class dimension in a kind of blue-collar versus white-collar impact. If you're a white-collar worker, you can sit at home for, in Britain, it's now 3 weeks of lockdown. And you can do that and you can work from home and you may not be too worried about your income. If you have to go to a supermarket, suddenly this is a real challenge for you. You know, you have to go and work there. You have to actually physically be present. It's a real sort of divide that emerges in the workforce. And it's become a political issue in addition, because, you know, whilst the government here has said we will give 80% income support up to £2,500 for those people laid off during this period of time, if you're employed, if you're self-employed, which is well over 5 million people now, it's a huge, great chunk of the workforce, there is at present really no support whatsoever. So it's opened up this kind of formal, informal economy divide very, very sharply, I think.
And you mentioned those measures. What else is your government doing now that they've abandoned the idiotic herd immunity strategy?
Well, it's sort of changed. I mean, officially, we had the kind of formal budget was, it seems a long time ago, but it was actually only a week and a bit ago, where there was initial sort of £15 billion additional stimulus spending. They realised last week that the world has gone well beyond talking about stimulus and made available £330 billion worth of mostly loans to businesses. Businesses are facing cash flow problems. Another loan on top of the loans you already have, and businesses are heavily indebted at the minute, is not actually the brilliant solution it appears to be. Really, these things need to be grants. They said last week they would also give this 80% income support up to a limit of £2,500 to people in employment. If you're self-employed and if you're in various forms of sort of fairly casualised work, then you have very little. You have to use the conventional benefit system. They've also said there's a holiday in mortgages. They haven't done the same thing for renters. They initially said they'd ban evictions for 3 months. That hasn't really happened. So if you're renting, you're still having to pay. So you're in a very bad position. If, for instance, you're in casualised work, you're notionally self-employed, so you have very few protections, and you have to rent, you are really, really going to financially suffer in the middle of all this. And there's a public health aspect. It's the sort of fundamental part of like dealing with this pandemic, is that everybody has to self-isolate who can do. That means basically everybody has to do this, and that's how you stop it. If you have a few people wandering around, that is a breach in the defences against the virus. So you can't have that. So it's essential that the same kind of coverage is given to everyone, which is why, of course, the arguments around things like universal basic income have really come through in quite a big way, because it's literally the same money paid to everyone and therefore everyone's covered.
Now, you mentioned business debt. This is a parenthetical in the context of this, but U.S. businesses went on a borrowing spree over the last several years, mainly to take over each other and buy their own stock to boost its value. Has British business done something similar?
Very similar. I don't think it's quite as advanced as it is in America, but it's a very similar thing. And on one side, it's an enormous stack of corporate debt, and the other side, a great deal. And the US has the same issue of basically hoarding of cash by companies, tech companies in the US in particular, slightly more generalized over here, but basically large corporations sitting on very, very significant cash piles, smaller businesses loaded up with debt. Now, as you say, it's sort of not the immediate issue that we face, is a potential financial crisis around this. What we face is a public health crisis of an immense scale. But clearly, somewhere down the line, if cash flow is grinding to a halt, and it really is, I mean, the projections on GDP that I've seen for the US are Goldman Sachs seeing a 30% decline for the second quarter. Looking at the early indicators in the UK, the Purchasing Managers Index, which tells you, you know, people in factories, are they still buying things, has gone through the floor. It's been a worse decline of factory orders than we saw in 2008 and 2009. So that suggests a similar decline in GDP, which means catastrophic cash flow issues for a huge number of businesses. If they're also loaded up with debt, then this is an incipient financial crisis of a very high order. I think what we're going to see this time around is the combination of both the obvious pandemic crisis and its particularly intense impact on labour markets and therefore on the core institution of capitalism, combined with this potential financial crisis. I think arguments for things like a more generalised debt write-off, I think, will become more pressing as the months go on. I suspect if we get out of this, we will end up with an argument for a sort of debt amnesty over this period of time.
Another thing our two countries share, aside from a rather slow response to this crisis, is just that we've both been ravaged by neoliberalism over the recent decades. How did that prepare us, or leave us unprepared for this crisis.
That's the really striking thing. The contrast between countries that had a state capacity that was still there and could move quickly, and countries where the state had been hollowed out. So in Britain, 10 years of austerity since the crash had really chewed away at basic state functions. Things like public health funding had gone through the floor. Local authorities here in Britain are supposed to do a lot of this stuff. They've seen their funding cut by 60%. So the public health spending wasn't there to prepare. The NHS, National Health Service, is under an enormous amount of pressure due to funding issues. And frankly, if you look at the scenes in Italy, where the health services, and actually very good health services in the north of Italy, are completely overwhelmed by the number of people requiring treatment, this will be happening in Britain in very short order, probably within the next week or so. And it's a condition of the neoliberal state, is that it is permanently underprepared. It is permanently living at the point at which the market is providing everything, so there is no need for the government to step in. And worse than that, I think you end up with an entire political class that just cannot think in these terms. That this accounts for some of the slow response, that you had both a government that couldn't believe that it needed to do anything, and then you have a kind of media, a sort of particularly kind of senior political journalists and things, who didn't feel the need to scrutinise what government was doing. And there's an entire kind of political institutional setup here that isn't geared at all to deal with the government has to now step in and do something in a big way. It just can't think like that. And that it's 7 weeks really of delay in this country before things started moving. Once it became apparent just how serious the crisis was, once the first few instances of COVID-19 appeared in the UK, it was just delay. And that delay means the curve has not been flattened to the extent it should have been, to use the now popular jargon. And it means that, as I said, many more people die. That's the fairly obvious projection from where we are now and the government failure that we've seen last few weeks.
I'm speaking with the economist James Meadway. Add to that lack of state capacity is the consciousness that has been created of these 40 years of the neoliberal era. Thatcher's famous declaration, there's no such thing as society, and we've had equivalent things over here. This has created this an absolute lack of any consciousness of solidarity in the population, or at least its atrophy.
I don't know about that. I think what's so dramatic about the 40 years of neoliberalism and that kind of underlying idea that there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals and their families, whatever Thatcher phrased it as. The fact that you have governments who basically kind of think like this has had some impact on how people think and behave. But what's quite striking is how much of this sort of elementary forms of solidarity are still there. So there are any number of support groups being set up on a local basis. There are people attempting to sort of collectivise some of these responses. What's been peculiar about this crisis is the way that neoliberal bit of there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals, gets kind of inverted into that means it is individuals' fault if there is no food on the shelves. Now, the reason there's no food on the shelves in supermarkets, to be absolutely clear, is because people have bought slightly more than they would have done on their weekly shop otherwise. There are some instances of a few people going absolutely wild and trying to get every bundle of toilet paper they can get their hands on for whatever reason. That is happening in a few cases, but that isn't enough to knock out your entire supply chain. What matters there is just-in-time logistics, where you have very, very small inventories at supermarkets and in the warehouses. You rely on being able to deliver things for basically people doing pretty frequent but not very large shops, and the entire supermarket system is geared up to work towards that. If only a few people, or in this case actually quite a lot of people, shift their spending ever so slightly, so they're buying a little bit more than they were because they're thinking it's going to be 2 weeks or 3 weeks in lockdown, suddenly that starts to wipe out the supermarkets and the food on the shelves and the rest of it. But the rhetoric from government, which has been totally unclear about how people should behave in this crisis, by the way, the initial advice was wash your hands and sing happy birthday twice and that's enough. And then, up until basically yesterday, it was we advise you not to go to the pub. We advise you not to go out too much. I mean, what use is this? They're not giving any additional financial support to a whole load of people. There's nothing there to tell you how serious it is. And there's this all stuff now, it's just like flu. Totally unclear messaging. But the government and people around it are now saying, it's the fault of all these selfish individuals buying too much or going to the beach because it's sunny or whatever. Absolute nonsense. This is a government failure. It's a catastrophic failure of public health and public health communications in particular. But it's that neoliberal ideology of saying, it's your fault. And it's all these terrible brutes out there not realising, in fact, there is such a thing as society and behaving like individuals and it's their fault. So it's quite striking, I think, how the ideology is shifting around this.
Now, one of the features of the contemporary era are these global supply chains that extend halfway around the world and require prompt deliveries, just-in-time inventories. This whole model of the organization of production is really under severe challenge now. What do you think will come of this?
there's a couple of things. I mean, the first one, the most obvious one, is that there was a, I mean, put it this way, there was a kind of notorious incident about 2 years ago when a crash, fairly serious crash, it was six or seven vehicles involved outside a warehouse in Rugby in the Midlands, in the middle of the country, was enough to stop Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, having any chicken in its shops for like a week and a half. And that's like one single incident knocks out their entire logistics. So what we've got now is that incident absolutely everywhere. So working assumption is, of course, that supplies are going to get tight. That's the first one. That's the most immediate crisis. And at that point, government, I think, will have little choice but to step in and intervene in a more dramatic way than it has done at the minute. I don't doubt there's sort of behind the scenes discussions taking place with the big supermarkets. Implicitly, a few of them have started introducing rationing systems. They're preventing people from buying more than two of any given item, that sort of thing. So it's a rationing system that's already been introduced there. That will probably get more extensive over the next few weeks or so. Looking longer term, this looks very much like, if we come out of this immediate crisis relatively soon, within the next sort of 5-6 months or so, then out the other side, the working assumption, I think, would be for a lot of people, similar to what happened with the financial crisis, where suddenly there's an awareness that a systemic breakdown can happen, and therefore banks change their behaviour, governments change their behaviour regarding banks, regulators put in more controls on what banks can do. You change how the system operates. Once there's an awareness of this pandemic risk, you'll expect capitalism in general to behave a bit differently, and that will probably mean cutting supply chains rather than having these massively extended, very, very fragile supply chains right the way across the globe. You'll probably see a retrenchment of all that because the cost of trying to run these things will suddenly look very high.
Over the last 10 years, you wrote this in your New Statesman piece, there has been a reduction in cross-border financial flows after the financial crisis. What does that mean? What's behind that? How do you read that?
The driver of that is the behavior of international banks, which, if you take the sort of 10 years at least up until the financial crisis, they were the linchpins of the international financial system. So an enormous part of what you saw as cross-border financial flows is basically banks trading things either amongst themselves or to businesses in different countries. And that was one of the drivers of the expansion of the system as a whole. There's a real retrenchment afterwards. Basically, banking becomes sort of nationalized in the sense that banks return to their home markets much more so than they used to. And that's the big driver of the financial flows. If you look underneath the picture, there are other financial flows that have grown over that period of time. There are more sort of various forms of speculative investment and that sort of thing. But overall, if you take those 10 years since 2008 and 2009, it's a stretch to call it deglobalization, but world trade has not grown as much as the economy. 30 years beforehand, world trade grew faster than the global economy. More of the economy got traded. Finance has actually shrunk in terms of cross-border flows, so it's become certainly less globalized in that sense. And then if you look at what's happened with the pandemic and some of the likely consequences of it, you have the risks that are now implied in having very extended supply chains and globalization in this form, then you'd expect it to be an accelerant of those processes, that you end up with a more deglobalized world in that sense.
Now, there's some people who seem to think that the global economy now is like a light switch. We just turned it off and then we can turn it on again in a few months. How likely is that?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is sort of cataclysmic if you have a system that is one way or the other predicated on the need to accumulate and compete. I mean, this is the dynamic of capitalism. For 200 or more years, the thing that always drives growth, that always pushes it further and further, that makes innovation happen, that transforms the entire world, is this sort of inner compulsion to accumulate capital and to do so competitively, which forces you to accumulate more capital. If you're then having to say, this must stop, this has seismic consequences, which, of course, is what we're now looking at. I mean, there are other parts of this impact. I would have thought that the appearance of the state suddenly breaks down the idea that the state can't really do anything, because it kind of has to at some point. I strongly suspect, and this is a more speculative point really, but I strongly suspect that the sheer kind of trauma, the psychological impact of seeing what happens over the next sort of month or so here is going to change how people think about the world. So the chances of getting out of this the other side and everything, you know, you dust yourself down and get back to normal, bouncing back, as Boris Johnson put it, I think is minimal to non-existent, to zero.
But now we can see some hints already that the foregrounding of the importance of labor is now, it's just visible to everyone. The importance of some kind of rebuilding of state capacity has become important. We're seeing some possibly accelerated signs of deglobalization. What do you think the longer term structural impacts of this crisis will be on the political economy?
The ones that obvious ones, or maybe not the obvious ones, the ones that seem likely are the states that moved fastest in trying to deal with this. So really you're talking at this point, you know, China, Taiwan, South Korea, arguably Germany, in Europe, and maybe a few others have got on top of it. The ones that move fastest there and took the costs and took the hits straight away are the ones who are going to emerge in the stronger position at the other side somewhere. The ones who delayed are going to face a long period of very, very high costs. I mean, that's just to be a bit sort of crude about the economics of it. That is in addition to the fact that it's a major social trauma and the horror of seeing large numbers of people die from this. So that's the setup you'd think coming out the other side. And by the way, if you're talking about in the US, if Goldman Sachs is seriously saying it's a 30% decline in GDP for a quarter, like that's the kind of drop that takes years, even at a healthy rate of economic growth, to make good again. If you look at, you know, what's happened since 2008-09 is basically low growth, particularly in, you know, North America, Europe, including Britain, that sort of thing. This is a permanent impact. This is just on the sort of raw look at the macroeconomic numbers. This is going to be a permanent impact, and it's going to reshape the world. It looks
well,
like
we're about $5,000 per capita GDP below the trend line before the 2007 collapse. So, exactly. This is going to compound that already yes. large shortfall.
Yes. And at that point, the balance of economic power in the world shifts, and it shifts away from, you know, the US and bits of Europe, and it shifts towards the East, bluntly, and it shifts, I think, decisively towards China. China is already supplying aid to Italy. I mean, this is a major shift in how the world operates and who's the more powerful nation and who isn't. That's one part of it. The other part of it, I think, is the appearance of the state and the engagement of the state in the economy in a way that was already happening post-2008. You had the bailouts, but then you increasingly had kind of state either state-owned companies or significant state intervention in particular markets and sectors appearing across the world. That, I think, will also accelerate that once you have the state having to manage chunks of the economy and deal with some of those risks, that isn't going to get unwound easily. So you get a more sort of version of state capitalism, if you like. You have the state and capital working together increasingly in the global economy, and in a global economy where perhaps trade and certainly finance and a few other things are not, these sort of international flows are not as prevalent as they used to be.
Looking at our two heads of state right now, it doesn't look like our political class is really up to that challenge.
Not even slightly. No, I mean, Boris Johnson thought he was going to get Brexit done, and that was what he'd be remembered for. He likes to compare himself, or he's fond of comparing himself to Winston Churchill. This appears to be a role model for him. He's fallen well short of that particular bar. I mean, The Times, which is... You
know, except for killing lots of people.
Well, yeah, you know, depends on your view of Churchill. I think he'd probably take a slightly rosier view. No, The Times, you know, the establishment paper here, really, par excellence, had a absolutely devastating, I thought, leader yesterday, saying he was not Churchill, he's Neville Chamberlain, you know, this complete failure of a prime minister that Churchill replaced, which is pretty devastating if you're Boris Johnson. And frankly, he has this haunted look about him by this point. He really doesn't look like he's on top of it, because he isn't. He is, at this point in time, trying to chase a sort of exponential growth curve, which is the spread of the virus, and he's failing to catch up with it, and he's failing to get on top of it.
And finally, you conclude the New Statesman's piece by saying, first time in decades, the terrain may not be decisively skewed against those who work. What do you have in mind there?
I mean, look, this really is getting a bit more speculative, but at least one plausible outcome from this is that if we're in a world where, well, first of all, take this current COVID-19 outbreak. Perhaps we get immunity, perhaps there's a second or third or fourth waves of it, perhaps it becomes endemic in the population. So that implies that we could find ourselves in similar periods of this, probably not quite as bad, over a long period of time. And the rate of pandemics and epidemics globally is increasing. I mean, this is the side effect of environmental impacts in various different ways, including climate change. So we'd expect more of these things to happen. And if that is going to be the case, then there will have to be permanent constraints applied to labour, that you can't have people going off to work if going off to work is the thing that leads to this devastating social and economic cost, which is the spread of an epidemic. And once labour becomes constrained, other things being equal, labour is going to be in a better bargaining position than it would have been otherwise. I mean, it's quite a crude point, but I think it more or less applies. You perhaps get glimmers of this already. The fact that the government, this conservative government, no friend of the trade unions by a very long way, invited the TUC in to sort of negotiate over protections for those in employment, and they basically signed up to everything the TUC wanted in terms of employed workers. This is the 8% of income that you can get from the government if you're made redundant. That already starts to look like a glimmer of a shift in the balance of power back towards Labour after 30, 40 years under neoliberalism, where, you know, the shift has been very much in the other direction. So there is some potential there for quite a major restructuring of how capitalism operates in lots and lots of different levels. And perhaps some of it opens up this space where Labour is in a stronger position than it would have been, you know, a decade ago.
That was James Meadway, a former economic advisor to the British Labour Party. He's got an article on all this on the New Statesman's website.
You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Scarlatti's Sonata No. 390 in the Kirkpatrick catalog, performed by Scott Ross. Next, infectious diseases. COVID-19 is what's known as a zoonotic disease, one that leaps from animals to humans. Others include AIDS, Ebola, plague, and flu. David Quammen is a distinguished and prolific science journalist whose 2012 book Spillover, published by Norton, is a look at all these afflictions. David Quammen. Welcome, David. Thank you for joining us during this very busy time.
Great to be with you, Doug.
Is this the big one you speculated about throughout the book?
Well, it's one of them. I talk about the next big one in the book Spillover, and I asked a number of scientists, what is the next big one going to look like? And the composite image that they gave me 10 years ago when we were having those conversations was essentially what we have now. They said the next big one, well, it'll be caused by a virus. The virus will be zoonotic. That means it'll emerge from an animal, probably a wild animal, very possibly a bat. What kind of virus? Well, it'll be a virus with the capacity to evolve quickly and to adapt to a new host. For instance, a coronavirus. So coming out of a bat, where? Well, possibly in a wet market where live animals are sold along with all other kinds of food, possibly in China. All of that was there.
Yeah, I noticed several of the people you interviewed mentioned coronaviruses specifically. Now, this is a kind of virus that the common cold is the most famous disease it causes, but until fairly recently, it hadn't caused any serious diseases. Is that right?
Well, no. It was SARS in 2003 was a coronavirus.
Well, that's right. I'm counting that as fairly recently.
Okay, yes, right. Yes, yes, you're right that some forms of the common cold are belong in this family, the coronaviruses. Others belong in another family, but this family is most notorious in recent years or decades for the fact that the SARS virus belonged to it. And SARS scared the bejesus out of scientists and public health officials in 2003, although it didn't get away. It didn't get out of control the way this one has. But since SARS, scientists have been saying, watch out for another coronavirus because these little bugs evolve very quickly, and they do live in animals that we come in contact with, and they could bring us something that would be worse than SARS, and here we are.
Bats seem to be very heavily involved in these diseases, these pandemics. What is it about bats?
You're right, that bats seem to be disproportionately implicated as the natural hosts of these viruses. The scientists call them sometimes reservoir hosts or natural hosts. The creature in which a virus lives inconspicuously, sort of chronically over long periods of time, until that moment when it spills over into the human population and starts to cause a disease. SARS, that earlier coronavirus, it resides in bats. Marburg, which is a cousin of Ebola, has its reservoir host in bats. Ebola probably has its reservoir host in bats. A number of others, Nipah virus in Malaysia, Hendra virus in Australia. And so people start to ask, what is it about bats? And there are a couple of answers. First of all, bats are incredibly diverse. They are the most diverse order of mammals. One in every four species of mammal is a species of bat. Even if they weren't disproportionately represented per species, they would seem to be dominating as the origins of these viruses. But there are a couple of other things. bats can live a long time. A little bat can live 18 or 20 years. A mouse is lucky to live 1 or 2 years. They roost in huge aggregations. So you might have 60,000 little bats all snuggled together on the wall of a cave, 3 bats deep with the pups at the breast of the mother. Great situation for exchanging viruses, circulating viruses. And then there's also evidence, this is still a little bit hypothetical, but there's evidence that evolution has dialed down the immune systems of bats for complicated reasons that allows them to fly. And so if they live a long time, they live in dense aggregations, no social distancing, and their immune systems are dialed down, this is just the perfect situation for viruses to circulate in bat populations.
Okay, now the concept at the core of your book is the zoonosis. What does that mean? And as you ask yourself, why obsess about them?
A zoonosis is an animal infection that's transmissible to humans. Could be a virus, might also be a bacterium or a fungus or some other sort of an infectious microbe, but whatever it is, it comes out of non-human animals, gets into humans. When it does that the first time, that event is called spillover. And if it replicates in humans, say it's a virus, replicates in humans and then manages to transmit from one human to another, causing disease, we call that a zoonotic disease. And why obsess about these? Because most of our infectious diseases fall into this category, including the infamous old ones like bubonic plague and the scary newer ones like Ebola and SARS. The influenzas are all zoonotic, and now this thing, the virus that causes COVID-19. So if we care about understanding infectious disease in humans, then we have to think about zoonoses, and we have to think about the spillover of these things from non-human animals.
One of the fascinating aspects of your book is that AIDS didn't originate anywhere near as recently as we think it did. Tell the story of the origin of AIDS and early 20th century.
Right. A very, very counterintuitive story. I was astonished myself when I came across this, but it's all supported now by good science, good molecular biology. We now know the crucial original spillover of the pandemic strain of the HIV virus, 34 million deaths on planet Earth. That original spillover was a virus passing from a single chimpanzee into a single human in the southeastern corner of Cameroon around 1908, give or take a margin of error. Very, very different from what most people think they know about the origins of the AIDS pandemic. You know, we first heard about it in the U.S. in 80 and 81, but it'd been with us probably for 70 or 80 years at that point, moving very quietly, inconspicuously, originally with probably a low rate of successful transmission, killing people slowly if they didn't already die of some other cause, malaria or starvation or something else in one of those Cameroonian villages, and finally making its way down the river system and then to what then were the big cities, Brazzaville, capital of French Congo, and what was then Leopoldville, the capital of what was then the Belgian Congo, a city that's now Kinshasa, capital of Democratic Republic of the Congo. So it got to those cities, and then from those cities, it got to the world. It got to the U.S. probably by way of Haiti, and then from Haiti to the U.S. probably by way of blood products that were harvested in plasma centers, paying people a pittance for the plasma from their blood in Haiti, and then shipping it up to the U.S. to be used in hospital situations.
There's a moralizing discourse that arises around diseases like this, patient zero, super spreaders. These things have a moral component, and the way our president he just calls it the Chinese virus and over again, it's really not a good idea to assign any kind of moral blame to anybody involved in all this.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And you're right that does tend to get done, though. There is an onus that is put upon some individuals and some populations. Patient Zero, that Canadian flight attendant, we now know he wasn't anything like Patient Zero. Trump wants to call this the Chinese virus or Wuhan virus. It used to be that viruses were named after the places where they were first noticed or identified, but that has passed out of fashion among civilized people because of the stigmatizing that it involves. These things happen for various reasons. It's not one person's fault. It's not the fault of a particular population. Yes, there are practices in China that are very risky practices that need to be curtailed, like taking wild animals, capturing them live out of the wild, and bringing them in cages to be sold in food markets amid all sorts of other kinds of food. That is risky behavior, risky for the whole planet. There will be pressure on China to firmly close down that trade, not just legally, but in the underground, the black market too. But there's enough responsibility to go around. There's enough responsibility for all of us. Anybody who owns a computer or a cell phone is participating in the industry that mines coltan, a very important mineral for use in tantalum capacitors in computers and cell phones. And that stuff is mined in the southeastern corner of the Democratic Republic of Congo by miners who are probably eating bushmeat, living adjacent to rich tropical forests filled with lowland gorillas and bats of all sorts. So when you buy a cell phone, as a consumer, you are exerting a demand draw on the mining of coltan, and that's another way, an excellent way, where humans may get infected with a new virus from a non-human animal.
Now, these kinds of zoonoses are as old as humanity, really, but what have we been doing lately to worsen the problem?
Yeah, you're right that they are ancient. Some of the ancient plagues were, we can be sure, zoonotic, including the bubonic plagues of the 14th century. In that case, a bacterium spilling over from rats through fleas into humans. But we are doing things differently. So these things seem to be happening more often and potentially with greater consequences now. Because of what? Well, because there are now 7.7 billion of us humans on the planet, an incredible abundance of large-bodied, hungry, enterprising creatures that are putting great draws on the natural world. I mean, when you think about it, the 1918 influenza that killed probably 50 million people around the planet, that was in a much different world, and there were only about 2 billion of us then. So we've quadrupled the human population since the 1918 influenza. And think of how the travel has changed. We can fly around the world now in 20 hours or so. So we are much more abundant. We are exerting much more consumer pressure on the natural world, and we are much more interconnected with our shipping, our transport of goods, not just animals, but all kinds of goods, and with our travel around the world. So that makes us more likely to experience these spillovers and more likely for any given spillover to turn into a global pandemic.
Habitat loss is a very important part of this story, right?
It is, yes. For instance, I'm talking about these rich tropical forests, rich ecosystems of various sorts. The one fascinating grim case is the case of a virus called Nipah virus. It causes Nipah virus disease that has killed people in Malaysia and Bangladesh. First discovered in 1998 in Malaysia. Why? Well, because they were cutting down their tropical forests for various purposes, for timber, probably also for oil palm plantations. And in those diverse Malaysian forests lived large fruit bats feeding on wild fruit. As the forest disappeared, the fruit bats had to look elsewhere for food. There were big industrial scale pig farms being established in northern Malaysia at that point with thousands of pigs in a corral. And as an additional income stream, the pig farmers were planting fruit trees to shade their piggeries, their pig corrals. So the bats, deprived of their wild forest, came to feed on the fruit trees overhanging the pig farms. They dropped fruit pulp, they dropped feces, they dropped urine, they dropped virus, this Nipah virus, on the pigs. It spread through the pigs, it spread to pig farmers, butchers, pork sellers, and other people with a kill rate much higher than what we're seeing now with the COVID-19 virus. So habitat destruction is what drove that particular situation, and there are other situations like that around the world.
I'm speaking with the science journalist, David Quammen.
Well, even like suburbanization and Lyme disease, that's a fascinating story too.
Yes. Lyme disease loves the suburbs of Connecticut, New England generally, loves these situations where you've got suburban and semi-rural situations. You know, you've got a little patch of trees, you've got a hedgerow, you've got a nice yard, then your neighbor has another patch of trees, another hedgerow, you got kids playing out there and all that. You've got, which mouse is it? I can't remember. Several different kinds of mice that carry it.
The white-footed mouse?
The white-footed mouse. Thank you. Yeah. I was getting it confused with the mouse that carries hantavirus, which is generally the deer mouse in the West and elsewhere. So Lyme disease loves suburban situations. just the way white-tailed deer love suburban situations and white-footed mice do.
Part of the reason is that instead of having long expanses of forest, you have these isolated things that are separated by roads and sidewalks. What difference does it make? Why is that important?
Well, you're reminding me of parts of my book, Doug, that you remember better than I do.
Oh, I just read it.
but you're absolutely right, yes. And I followed a scientist who was leading a study on this. The fact that the landscape there in New England is fragmented into these hedgerows and little patches of forest and yards and things means not only that the white-footed mice are doing well, but the larger animals that would prey on white-footed mice are doing less well. So there is a greater abundance of mice, and they're carrying a higher prevalence of the bug that causes Lyme disease than there would be and there is in good, intact, highly diverse New England forest that has not just small rodents running around, but sort of medium-sized, both mammals and birds that would prey on small rodents, a higher diversity. So as the diversity goes down, Lyme disease goes up.
Yeah, diversity is very important in this story, right?
Very absolutely. Yes, yes.
What can we do about these things? We just have to learn to live with them, die with them, adapt to them? Or are there things that humans can do? As you said, I'll say several times in the book, we're resourceful people, sometimes for good and sometimes for ill. But what can we do to minimize the risks of these in the future?
There are things we can do. There's a category of things that sort of are scientific and technological, and there's another category of things that are a little bit more political and public health sorts of things. So the scientific and technical, we can do more work on discovering what viruses are out there that might be threatening to us. That's generally called viral discovery. And we're starting to get going on that and do a pretty good job. There's some great scientists working on that. There's some organizations focused on that. A fellow named Dennis Carroll, former major public health officer in the federal government, is now running a group called Global Virome Index or Project, something like that. And they're doing that, trying to discover more and more what's out there. We have some great disease scientists who, when there is an outbreak, suddenly people get sick in a place like Malaysia or Wuhan, China or whatever. These people come in fast. Some of them are Chinese. Some of them are nationals from the various places. Some of them are international, sort of SWAT team people that come in, and they work quickly to identify, where did this come from? What kind of a virus is this? Where did it come from? Why did it spill over from some animal into humans? What is that animal? How can we prevent that in the future? So preventive work. Then we have better and better capacity to identify, characterize virus quickly. Chinese researchers identified the genome of this particular new virus quickly and got that out to the rest of the world. Not quickly enough, but fairly quickly once their governments let them do that. We're doing well on that, sequencing the genomes of these viruses. And then the next step is we have to be able to create very quickly test kits so that we can find out who's infected and who's not. Not kits that are being slowly produced, as we've seen in inadequate supply, and kits that require 2 or 3 days before you get the results. We should be able soon to have test kits that would be able to identify whether a person is infected or not from a cheek swab run through a portable machine in the time it takes for a person to pass through airport security. Take off your shoes, take off your belt, put your thing down here, give us a cheek swab. Okay, come out on the other side, you're putting your belt and your shoes back on, and at that point or soon after, they're able to tell you whether you're positive or negative for COVID-23 or whatever the next one is going to be. A scientist 10 years ago was telling me that he and his lab were working on that, but we still don't have that. We need that. And then there's the politics and public health side. We need, and this is obvious stuff we've all been hearing about, we need excess capacity. We need more hospital beds than we'll ever need under ordinary circumstances, but we'll need under extraordinary circumstances. We need more ICU units. We need more ventilators. We need more stockpiled masks, gloves, gowns, personal protective equipment. We need to spend a lot of money being prepared for something that might or might not happen this year or next year or the year after. That's where politics comes in. Politicians tend to be averse to taking that kind of risk, spending a lot of money on preparedness that might not turn out to be necessary during their particular administration.
And what about, you know, human relation to the Earth? It seems like we really need to live a bit more lightly than we do, and fly less, and clear less land, and
I agree totally.
Consume a bit less, right? Like, just to talk about that a bit. What can we do in that regard?
That's the big lesson, and that's the hard sell. We have to look at ourselves in the mirror. We have to say, am I flying too many miles on airplanes? Am I eating too much meat per week? How many children am I going to have? What sorts of things am I going to consume otherwise? Yes, we need to think about all those things in terms of the amount of disruption we're causing to the natural world, the amount of drain and draw we're putting on the natural world, individually and collectively as a 7.7 billion individual mass of needs and wants. That's the hard part. That's the part where people like you and me and others who have the privilege of talking to audiences, that's where we have to be imaginative and impassioned and persuasive and help ourselves and other people think about how to do that, how to live a little bit more lightly on the land.
And I imagine climate change is only going to make this worse.
Yes. Yep. Climate change connects up with this in several different ways. For instance, some of these diseases are spread by mosquitoes. Some of our infectious diseases, even ones that originated in other kinds of creatures, you know, say maybe they're ancient in monkeys, but now that humans are invading tropical forests, now we are one of the targets of that too. But they're carried by mosquitoes, vectors who seek us out. Yellow fever, malaria, dengue. And as climate change moves temperatures around and it gets warmer and warmer in higher latitudes in the northern hemisphere, for instance, the mosquitoes that carry those tropical diseases are going to be expanding their ranges so that they'll be moving north and bringing these diseases up to places where people aren't used to them. That's just one instance of how climate change is connected with this.
Now, some of these big diseases flare up and disappear. Some persist for a long time. Obviously, you have no way of knowing which way this is going to go, but what are the possibilities?
You're right that we don't know, and the possibilities, I'd say, are broad with this particular virus, this particular situation. When Ebola flared up and caused a terrible epidemic in three West African countries in 2014, Ebola makes people very sick very quickly. It doesn't travel very well on airplanes, and it doesn't pass from silent spreaders to any great degree, as far as we know. So it doesn't circulate through communities as quickly and as invisibly, insidiously, as, for instance, this virus does. And so we got that under control. We, meaning the people, the brave people who helped both from those countries and came into those countries, and they put that fire out. They stopped that Ebola outbreak. Where is that Ebola virus now? Well, it's hiding in its reservoir host somewhere. It's not gone from the planet, but it's not in humans anymore. There's another Ebola outbreak that's just ending in eastern DR Congo, and when that is finally ended, there will be no Ebola cases in any humans. But there are other diseases, for instance, the influenzas, where you never get rid of them all from humans. They just circle and circle and circle and eventually are replaced by another virus that's worse, or people get adapted to them, having experienced them once are not susceptible again. Measles has been circulating on the planet for ages and ages, and it's still circulating. And there is a chance, as I hear and others of us are hearing from the scientific experts, that we will never put this fire entirely out, the virus that causes COVID-19. We will not get the last of it. It will continue to circulate probably as an endemic human disease, the way measles and some of these others still do. We don't think of measles as a scary, lethal disease, but measles, when it comes into a new population of people, a naive population of people, it kills a lot of individuals. Measles does. So this may eventually subside into being a dangerous but not very conspicuous circling endemic disease of the human population. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but I hear some scientists that I trust saying that that is a possible scenario.
So we're going to have to manage it, but we will not extinguish it.
I don't see how we're going to be able to extinguish it, and we'll have to learn how to manage it. We can do things, for instance, as we do with measles, we can develop vaccines to protect large populations from it, as long as everybody gets vaccinated. But there's always resistance to that. unfortunately. But that's the kind of solution that I hope we can reach with this, is that it will become routine for your child to have the opportunity to be vaccinated against the COVID-19 virus while a youngster in school.
And finally, towards the end of the book, you say, if we can't predict a forthcoming influenza pandemic or other newly emergent virus, we can at least be vigilant. We can be well prepared and quick to respond. We can be ingenious and scientifically sophisticated in the forms of our response. Just in recent weeks, it seems like some countries have done a much better job of that than ours.
Absolutely. Yeah. South Korea seems to have done a good job. The island city-state of Singapore has done a good job. China has gotten control, it seems, of theirs with some very draconian social control measures, but it seems to have worked. Hong Kong, until very recently, seemed to be doing well. I think Taiwan has done well. Italy has fared very poorly. I don't think that's because Italy has a bad healthcare system. I think their healthcare system is supposed to be one of the best in Europe. But Italy seems to have been very unlucky right at the beginning. Now, Spain is doing very poorly right now, and we have been hapless in the U.S., to put it politely, in terms of our response to this. Somebody could write a whole book in hindsight.
I'm sure there will be many, but it seems highly unlikely that we'll be filling the pews and open for business by Easter, though, right?
I think it's highly unlikely that Donald Trump even will be in a pew on Easter.
That was David Quammen, author of Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, published by Norton in 2012. That's a prescient subtitle if there ever was one. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, a song originally aimed at Ronald Reagan, but one that can be productively repurposed against a repulsive liar and incompetent Trump. President Gas by the Psychedelic Furs. Till next week, bye.